Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from antiwar.com. This is anti-war news for Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. All right, the first story at the top of antiwar.com today. Israel says that it has no choice but to respond to Iran. So Axios reported on Monday that Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant told Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin that Israel has no choice but to respond to Iran's missile and drone attack, which came in retaliation for Israel's bombing of Iran's consulate in Damascus. Gallant and Austin spoke on Sunday after President Biden told Netanyahu that the U.S. would not support an Israeli attack on Iran. So we have the U.S. trying to portray the Iranian attack as a victory for Israel, signaling that they don't want an escalation. But at the same time, the U.S. is also reaffirming that it will continue to defend Israel, and that means if there's another escalation. And the White House also said that it's up to Israel whether or not they respond to Iran. So they're not really putting any real pressure on Israel, it seems like. According to the Pentagon, Austin told Gallant that the U.S. does not seek escalation, but he added that the U.S. will continue to defend Israel. So if the U.S. is willing to defend another, if Israel attacks Iran and then Iran attacks again and the U.S. is saying they're willing to defend them, then that is supporting a potential Israeli attack if they're willing to defend Israel from the consequences of it. So Israeli TV reported on Monday that the Israeli war cabinet convened again and agreed to respond to the Iranian attack clearly and forcefully, but there are no details on what the response would look like. The report said that the war cabinet agreed that the attack must send the message that Israel will not allow an attack of that magnitude against it to pass without a reaction. So there's a few ways that Israel could respond to this thing. They could go back to, their old ways of more covert attacks. They have intelligence assets, inside Iran. They carry out a lot of covert attacks there, like assassinations, sabotage attacks, small drone attacks. And there's also the possibility that they target Iran in Syria again, or if they just, target some of Iran's allies in the region, like Hezbollah or some of the Shia militias that operate in Syria. I guess that's a potential response. If they really want to hit Iranian territory, that would be the big escalation here. And could they really do that without support from the U.S.? I'm not sure. So we'll see what comes of this. I keep seeing that there's lots of conflicting reports. Some say that an Israeli response is imminent. Some say that they're going to take their time. So we don't know exactly what's going to happen here. And only time will tell what the Israelis do next. And another question is, if Israel does do kind of one of those covert attacks or bombs more Iranians in Syria, Iran is saying that if Israel strikes them again, that they'll launch an attack even bigger. So would they launch an attack even bigger in response to, something more covert? I'm not sure. All right, so the next story here, Hezbollah attack wounds 4 Israeli troops in Lebanon. So this article is from Jason Ditz. So an overnight incursion into southern Lebanon by Israel's Golani Brigade left at least 4 Israeli troops wounded, one of them severely, when they ran into explosive devices planted by Hezbollah when they crossed the border. So they tried to do a little operation inside Lebanon. And Israel evacuated the troops who were hundreds of meters into Lebanon by helicopter and reported the situation was under review. They did not immediately confirm Hezbollah's version of events. Also overnight, Israel attacked and destroyed a house in the town of Sedekin, southern Lebanon. The attack wounded 9 people and badly damaged dozens of surrounding homes. So this has become a common occurrence in southern Lebanon. Israel claims that it hits terrorist infrastructure that turns out to be civilian homes in residential neighborhoods. Over 1,000 homes are estimated to have been damaged by such attacks. That is a lot. And it goes to show how, even though this isn't considered a full-blown war, this has been pretty heavy Israeli airstrikes across the border and Hezbollah attacks on northern Israel. And I know that the casualties on the Lebanon side are much higher than on the Israel side. All right, so the next one here, the White House opposes a standalone Israel aid bill. So the White House said on Monday that it opposes the idea of a bill that would give additional military aid to Israel without funding Ukraine and Taiwan. So White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said, quote, "We are opposed to a standalone bill that would just work on Israel. As we've seen proposed, we would oppose a standalone bill," end quote. So this came after House Speaker Mike Johnson said on Sunday that he was going to work on getting Israel more aid in the wake of this Iranian attack. But then later in the day on Monday, Johnson said that he's going to bring all of it, the Israel aid, the Ukraine aid, the Taiwan aid, to the floor for a vote, but they're going to be voted on separately, is what he said. And so this isn't good. I mean, if they're brought to the floor for a vote, each one, I think, would pass no problem through the House. And this is essentially the $95 billion foreign military aid bill that includes $60 billion for Ukraine, $14 billion for Taiwan. And then there's a few billion, about $4.8 billion that, $60 billion for Ukraine, $14 billion for Israel. And then there's about $4.8 billion for Taiwan and other spending in that region that wouldn't all go to Taiwan. But so he's saying that they're going to hold votes on them separately. And again, I'm sure that they're all going to pass. And as far as I know, his plan would give each country the same amount of money that's included in this $95 billion monstrosity. So it looks like, you know, they're finally going to get, I mean, again, if this is brought to the floor in the House for a vote, it'll pass. And then they'll probably have to vote on it again in the Senate. And I'm sure they'll pass it right through. And then that means all the aid, all the weapons money will be flowing again. All right, so the next one here, bipartisan lawmakers rush to battle stations after Iran attack. So this article is from Kelly Vlahos at Responsible Statecraft. And we actually had this as a viewpoint on yesterday's page, but I thought it was important just to go over some of the things the crazy hawks in Congress are saying about attacking Iran. So members of Congress who have said little to nothing about the over 33,000 Palestinians who've been killed in Gaza are swiftly calling the Iranian drone and missile attacks Saturday night a disproportionate response by Iran. And she mentions the background that Iran was responding to the killing of seven of its officials in what has been deemed by many, except most pro-Israel Western countries, as an illegal Israeli strike on the Iranian consulate in Syria on April 1st. Saturday's response by Iran has been called highly choreographed to send a message, even limited, and it was. After the missiles and drones started to fly, the Iranians literally broadcast that their message to Israel had concluded. So this hasn't stopped the howls from both Democratic and Republican members. Many of them who have sat on the sidelines of tens of thousands of Gazans have been punished for Hamas's attack. So just to go through some of the quotes here, and Kelly mentions that most of these are AIPAC funded, that these are all members of Congress who are funded by the Israel lobby. One was Representative Sheila Jackson. Sheila Jackson Lee, she's a Democrat from Texas. She said, quote, "Iran is a terrorist nation. They have just launched a disproportionate terrorist attack against our ally Israel. The free world and the United States will stand against this terrorist nation and the tyranny that it promotes." Marsha Blackburn, senator from, I think, Tennessee, she's a Republican. She said, quote, "Iran has been launching drone strikes on Israel. President Biden, we must move quickly and launch aggressive retaliatory strikes against Iran." So she's just saying the U.S. should start bombing Iran right away. Richie Torres said, quote, Richie Torres, he's a Democrat from New York. lots of AIPAC money. He said, quote, Iran has fired drones at Israel. The United States will stand with Israel as it seeks to defend itself in the face of an Iranian attack. Iran is the single most destabilizing force in the Middle East. It must be held accountable for the aggression it has long shown toward. Oh, I forgot that he actually blocked me on Twitter, so I can't read the rest of this. I forget what I said to him, but I think he's quick on the block button. But I'm sure it wasn't good, whatever else he had to say. And then Fetterman, what's his name? John Fetterman, senator, Democratic senator from Pennsylvania who beat Dr. Oz. He is just completely so pro-Israel, like more than some of the most hawkish Republicans. And basically went on the news and said, we have to have Israel's back and there should be no conditions. This is something I see him say all the time. No conditions for Israel, for aid to Israel, none. We have to have their back and you know, that's it. It's really something how pro-Israel he is for a new Democratic senator. All right. So the next one here, this is a really important story. Israel destroys 90% of buildings in the buffer zone. So Israel has destroyed nearly every building in Gaza along the strip's border with Israel to create what Israel is calling a buffer zone. And this plan will result in Israel taking a significant chunk of Gaza's territory. So a report from the United Nations Satellite Center found that Israel has destroyed or damaged 90% of the buildings in Gaza within 1 kilometer of the border as of February 29th. So that was over a month and a half ago at this point, so much more could be destroyed already. And this analysis found that 3,033 buildings were completely destroyed, and 327 were seriously damaged, and 266 were moderately damaged. So according to Haaretz, the real number of demolished buildings is likely higher since Israeli forces are actually creating the buffer zone 1,200 meters within Gaza, which is 200 meters further inside the strip than the UN examined. So that's 1.2 kilometers. So that's bigger than Israel initially said it was going to be. And according to an analysis from a professor at Hebrew University, Israel's buffer zone will take 16% of Gaza's territory. And besides demolishing buildings, they're also destroying agricultural land that is in these areas. And Israeli officials have framed this buffer zone as necessary to prevent a future October 7th style attack. But I see this as part of Israel's long-term plan to control Gaza, to conquer Gaza, to reestablish Jewish settlements in Gaza. I think this is all part of that plan. And the U.S. has been silent on this, as far as I know. I haven't seen any word about this from U.S. officials. And the U.S. claims that it does not support any plans that shrink Gaza's territory. And you have Israel claiming that it doesn't want to occupy Gaza, but at the same time, they're saying that they're going to have indefinite military access and control. But I think it's clear this is part of, again, just part of the plan to take over Gaza. And we really haven't seen much about this. You know, for the most part, Israel has been keeping a lid on this, even though this is a huge project that they're doing. They haven't been talking about it much. And I haven't seen any U.S. officials talk about it. I haven't seen many people in general talk about it. When this is, Israel is actively taking over 16% of Gaza's territory. And then what's to stop them from continuing to encroach further and further and further? You know, so it's just an example of them actively taking a piece of Palestinian territory. All right, so the next one here, Israeli forces kill 5 Palestinians trying to return to North Gaza. So 5 Palestinians were killed and 52 were wounded on Sunday when Israeli forces opened fire on a crowd trying to return to northern Gaza. And this was reported by the Associated Press, citing officials at the Auda Hospital in central Gaza. So thousands of displaced Palestinians attempted to return to the north on Sunday after they heard rumors that Israeli forces were allowing people in. But their hopes were dashed as Israeli troops opened fire on a crowd, and the Israeli military issued a new warning not to attempt to make the trek north. So The UN actually estimates that 84% of the homes in northern Gaza have been damaged or destroyed. So northern Gaza has almost been completely destroyed, but Palestinians who fled the area 6 months ago now, you know, it's been over 6 months, this thing, and for the people, displaced people, you know, that means they have been homeless for 6 months, living in tents and moving all around, trying to avoid the bombs and struggling to eat and find food. So they're saying that they want to return. They want to go back to the north, find their homes, I guess, see what condition they're in. An AP spoke with a few Palestinians who were trying to get to the north. And this has been a big issue between in the negotiations between Israel and Hamas. This is a condition Hamas wants, is for the free movement of Palestinians within Gaza so they can return to the north. And Israel has said no to that demand. I think they've proposed some sort of security, like letting a limited number of people in, or you know, setting up checkpoints or something. But as far as I know, they're still saying that they're not going to let them return to the north. And besides the buffer zone, Israel has also constructed a road, and I believe it's pretty wide, that separates northern Gaza from the south. And that is another thing that they say they're going to control, you know, indefinitely. So their forces can come in through the middle of Gaza to launch operations there. And they're using that to cut off the Palestinians from returning to the north. All right, so the next one here, Ukraine is jealous of the U.S. defense of Israel. So Ukrainian officials have expressed envy over the U.S.'s response to an Iranian drone and missile attack on Israel. The U.S., the U.K., France, and Jordan all intervened to help intercept Iranian drones and missiles. You know, I've seen these reports that the Saudis might have been involved, but as far as I've seen, that has not been confirmed. So that's not really clear. And then you have the Jordanians. They're saying, oh, we just, you know, shot down drones that violated our airspace. They didn't say that they defended Israel, but still people in Jordan aren't happy about that. The Palestinians that have been protesting at the Israeli embassy in Amman aren't happy about it. So Zelensky sees this and he said, quote, "The whole world saw that Israel was not alone in this defense. The threat in the sky was also being eliminated by its allies," end quote. The attack on Israel came as Russia has stepped up its missile and drone attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, which Moscow said was a response to Ukrainian attacks on oil refineries inside Russian territory. Ukraine has suffered serious blows in the strikes, as it's running low on air defenses and Russia's intelligence continues to improve. So Zelensky said, quote, "When Ukraine says that its allies should not turn a blind eye to Russian missiles and drones, it means action is needed, a bold one. It is not rhetoric that protects the sky. It is not opinions that curb the production of missiles and drones for terror," end quote. So the U.S. and NATO have not directly intervened to intercept missiles and drones, obviously, because it risks, you know, it risks direct war with Russia, which could quickly turn nuclear. Everybody knows why they're not directly intervening. And if you remember, in the early days of the war, Zelensky was asking Congress, he was asking the U.S. to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine, which would involve NATO shooting down Russian planes, having to bomb Russian missile systems inside Russia. So Zelensky was asking for World War III at first. There were not many takers in Washington. There were a few nutcases who supported that idea. Zelensky eventually stopped asking for the no-fly zone. So Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba acknowledged that the U.S. and NATO would not directly intervene, but called for more military aid. He said, quote, "Even if you cannot act the way you act in Israel, give us what we need and we will do the rest of the job," end quote. And then I just mentioned how, you know, Ukraine still hasn't gotten the aid, and we've seen all these, still hasn't gotten that $60 billion that Biden is looking for. So there's not getting too much aid from the U.S., although they have found some places to pull money from. And just the dire situation on the battlefield, the Ukrainian lines are collapsing. manpower shortages, just all these things. And despite all this, the U.S. wants to keep fueling this horrific war. All right, so the next one here, the U.S. says new Russian Arctic pipeline is dead in the water. So this article is from Kyle Anzalone at the Libertarian Institute, and it says a top U.S. official declared that Washington is using economic warfare to prevent Russia from completing a new liquefied natural gas pipeline in the Arctic. Officials in Washington, Kyle mentions how U.S. officials previously threatened the Nord Stream pipelines before they were destroyed. And this is an interesting character to be making this threat against this Russian LNG pipeline in the Arctic. It is U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Energy Resources, Jeffrey Pyatt. He explained that the U.S. had sanctioned Moscow in an effort to prevent the completion of a Russian pipeline in the Arctic, a project dubbed LNG2. So Pyatt, if that name sounds familiar, that's because in 2014, that notorious phone call that was leaked of Victoria Nuland speaking with another U.S. official about who should be, you know, in the next Ukrainian government, discussing, you know, the potential overthrow of the Ukrainian government, which then just happened a few weeks after that conversation. This was who she was talking to. It was Pyatt. He was the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine at the time. So now he's threatening another Russian pipeline. He said, quote, "Our role is to ensure Arctic LNG2 is dead in the water. We're very focused on ensuring that Russia is not able to develop new projects in order to redestine the gas that they previously sent to Europe. As the G7, we are collectively committed to doing everything we can to thwart Russia's future energy revenue," end quote. So part of this economic war against Russia, and you just imagine if the U.S. was building a pipeline somewhere near Alaska or something, I don't know, and Russia was saying that they were going to stop it. I mean, how would that look? How would Americans feel about that? And then Kyle mentions too, you know, one of the U.S. officials who threatened the Nord Stream pipeline was actually Victoria Nuland. So it's just interesting to see these officials, you know, that were involved in the coup in Ukraine in 2014 are still involved in Russia-Ukraine policy here and making threats, even though Nuland's on her way out. And Pyatt, you haven't heard much of him because he's an energy envoy. But here we have him making this threat. All right, so the next one here, what a year of conflict has done to Sudan. So this article is from Middle East Eye, just kind of an update on the situation in Sudan, which I haven't really been covering, but it's been a year now of fighting between the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, which is led by Hemeti, the Sudanese general, and they've been fighting the Sudanese army led by General Abdel Fattah el-Burhan. They're basically rival generals. They were part of this military government. They were like maybe not co-leaders. I think al-Burhan was technically in charge and Hemeti might have been number two, but they've been fighting. It started on April 15th last year. And there's a lot of, you know, reports of atrocities being committed by both sides. And according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, there have been more than 15,550 reported fatalities in Sudan over a year of war, and that number is considered to be a low estimate. It says that 32%, there's a lot of violence in Khartoum. Most of the violence is in the capital, Khartoum. And then in Darfur, where there's a lot of violence, they're saying it's twice as likely to be deadly for civilians in that region. So just a really bad situation for the people in Sudan. It's displaced 10.7 million people, and people are facing serious food shortages. They're warning of that famine could happen as a result of this war. Just under 4 million children under 5 are projected to suffer from acute malnutrition this year. Around 730,000 children are expected to suffer from life-threatening severe acute malnutrition, while more than 90% of the country's 19 million school-aged children have no access to formal education. So, you know, I see that I think it was Hemeti said the other day that he's open, you know, they're open to a new round of ceasefire talks, but I don't know how promising any of that is, because I know there's been talks going on basically this entire time. At some level or another, there's been attempts at ceasefires, but they never hold. So I don't know if there's really any end in sight to this thing right now. So that is it for the news for today. Please go check out our viewpoints, one from Ted Snyder: Biden's irresponsible war doctrine led to Iran's attack on Israel. One from Trita Parsi: Netanyahu wants war with Iran, Biden can prevent it. One from Ron Paul: FISA exchanges real liberty for phantom security. And one from Colonel Douglas McGregor: will Israel go nuclear on Iran? And one from Amira Haas: there's no way to quantify the suffering in Gaza. So please go check all of that out. Support this show by sharing it. Tell your friends about antiwar.com. Like, subscribe on YouTube or Rumble, wherever you prefer to watch. Follow us on Instagram, on X, all that stuff. I will be back tomorrow with some more news. Thanks for listening.